Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Hey, it's Molly Wood. We're taking a little break for the holidays and bringing you back some of our most popular episodes of the year. This summer, we talked about how colleges and universities were wrestling with reopening and how the pandemic could transform higher education. Our conversation with NYU marketing professor Scott Galloway really resonated with a lot of you and us. Since then, Scott has a new book out called Post-Corona: From Crisis to Opportunity. And as for universities, well, a lot of what Scott said came true, and many of them are still figuring out how to try to do school next semester. But before we roll the episode, I just want to take a second and say thank you for being part of the Make Me Smart family. Every question, voicemail, and donation makes a difference. If you're already giving, thank you so much for believing in what we do. And if you're not, there's still time. Donate today at marketplace.org/givesmart, and thank you. Because none of us is as smart as all of us.
Oh my goodness. There we go. Holy cow. Music starts. We start. Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizal. It's Make Me Smart, the Tuesday show, the big show. Good one today, actually, because it's a huge topic. Me and Molly Wood talking tech, the economy, culture. We are going to talk higher education today because holy cow, is it changing.
Uh-huh. And there, I mean, to be clear, I want to specify that we are going to talk about higher education today. We are well aware that there are so many conversations happening about education writ large, and some of that is contained within my news fix. But specifically, we've sort of been dancing around this topic a bunch. Kai has a furloughed college kid at home.
I do.
And And the closer we get to what could arguably be called fall, the more it becomes clear that there is going to be some sort of a seismic shift with respect to higher education. Yeah. The Wall Street Journal had a story the other day saying, like, now's a really good time to ask for a large discount on your college tuition. Mm-hmm. We don't know if anybody can really go back to school. And, you know, seemed like a good topic for this show.
So we've got Scott Galloway on the phone. He's a professor of marketing at the NYU Stern School of Business. He hosts the Pivot podcast with Kara Swisher. He's also got a new show on Vice TV. This guy does everything. It's called No Mercy, No Malice, which is named, by the way, after his blog. Scott Galloway, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So look, I want to go straight to your most recent post on that aforementioned No Mercy, No Malice blog. You wrote on Friday, this is how you started. It is time to end the consensual hallucination between university leadership, parents, and students that in-person classes will resume in the fall. Discuss.
Well, imagine sending a group of people who have demonstrated a lack of willingness to distance and putting them in a confined space with windows that don't open for 10 or 12 weeks as we speak to each other, and then distributing them to the four corners of the country, if not the four corners of the earth. It reads like the opening scene of Contagion 2. Mm-hmm. And essentially, when you get these very strident statements from university leadership, what it's Latin about how they're reopening and looking forward to welcoming their kids and students back to the campus, that's Latin for please send in your deposits. There is absolutely, in my view, no way we are going to hold in-person courses in 6 to 8 weeks from now. I think it's disingenuous. At best, it's delusional. But yeah, this just isn't going to happen.
I mean, do you think it's almost like a microcosm of kind of the American conversation writ large right now, right? Which is the economic trade-off versus the health trade-off versus just the sort of sheer panic that comes from what we don't know what to do if we don't get the deposits.
Well, just as if you think about it, the industries, most industries have just been accelerated. The trends that were in place are accelerating. We've gone from 18% of retail done via digital commerce channels to 28%. In some instances, though, we've had a really a meteor, an exogenous shock that's sort of a tectonic shift. And typically, those industries have one thing in common, and that it's the consumption of the core product as a function of people standing or sitting shoulder to shoulder, restaurants, sports, travel. and education. And the industry does not want to come to grips with the fact that 40 years of tuition raises and a fixed cost structure of tenured professors and what I would refer to as the Rolexification of these campuses means that if 20 to 30% of our kids don't show up in the fall, you could have 20, 30, 50% of these universities overnight in financial crisis. So we're all speaking to ourselves that things are going to be back to normal. They're not. Time is clicking by. And come September 1, even sooner than that, because we really have to make these decisions in the next 2 to 4 weeks. When I say we, I'm saying U.S. campus leadership. Mm. And the decisions are all going to be the same, that the protocols necessary to create anything resembling a responsible in-person class experience will be such a diminished impaired experience that it won't be worth the risk. And once the deposits we're getting have come in or not, we're going to announce that in the abundance of a caution, and this is all speculation, I don't speak for any university, including my own, we're going to announce that we're not going to do in-person courses, that it'll be all online. And if you want to send your kid to the campus, and we'll open the lawn and have distanced off-campus socialization to whatever extent your kids take risks or don't take risks. But the notion that we're going to be welcoming people back to class is nothing but a failed attempt to get people to continue sending in usurious fees.
Which is, of course, deeply, deeply cynical. But there's a flip side to this too, right?
Deeply.
Which is that if we're not going to do if we're not going to do in person,
doesn't mean I'm wrong, Kyle.
No, for sure, right? If we're not going to do in person, we can't not educate this 18-month tranche of college students, right?
Yeah.
But I think the spring has demonstrated that we're not equipped to do it online. I mean, I've got a rising sophomore at UCLA up in his childhood bedroom now doing stats online. Yep. At UCLA. And believe me when I tell you, it's not a great learning environment.
I agree with you, but I think it's situational. By the way, congratulations on your son going to the second greatest public university in the world, UCLA, where I did my undergraduate degree, then to go on to the best public university in the world for graduate school, Berkeley. But anyways, I think UCLA, I think if we spent a fraction of the time, leadership and administrators and faculty, figuring out how to make the online experience better, that we are trying to come up with these ridiculous protocols. And I mean, we're talking 3 or 4 meetings a day, dozens of task forces that are all from it. If we focused all of that energy in investing in small and big tech tools and figuring out a way to decrease the delta between the in-person and the offline experience, and then offer them some of that campus experience, the socialization, I think we would come out of this crisis in fighting shape to move to where the next generation of education needs to be. And that is offering education at a much lower price per student. So I do think you could get a long way there. I think we've come a long way just in the last 12 weeks in terms of the experience. And also, I understand, I know a bunch of people with 19-year-olds at home jonesing to get back to Tulane and UNC. Mm-hmm. But when you look at some of the hardship and sacrifice previous generations have had to make at that age, I don't think it's too much to say to them, look, you might return to Chapel Hill or Berkeley or Westwood, but your courses are going to be in person. What this is really about is universities panicking that if they don't offer a similar experience, or at least pretend that they're going to, that they will have to face something they haven't faced in 40 years, and that is cost cuts and offer people, students, a reduction in tuition. I think that's the source of the issue here.
Would it be a bad thing if universities had to cut costs, right? Because we know that cost structures are inflated in a lot of schools. And if they had to sort of take a really hard second look at the value that they're providing.
Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. And that's the opportunity here. And there is a huge opportunity. There's a silver lining the size of the cloud here. And that is, I'll be speaking to Chancellor Block at UCLA. And I've spoken to 6 university presidents or leadership just in the last week. The opportunity here is to strike a grand bargain with public governments or with our public leaders who have, to be honest, have cut budgets across our public universities as we focus on other priorities. But to say in return, we're going to reduce the cost of student per student delivery. I think these universities are almost constitutionally incapable of cutting their top line costs. What I do think we could do, though, is by embracing technology, reduce the cost per student. And that is, if you went to 50% online learning, and I think you could get there with very little erosion in the core value, you effectively double the size of the campus. And we could go back to the days of UCLA when I got in, when about a third of students who applied were admitted versus 12%. These universities and academics, and I'm part of the problem, suffer from this notion that we're no longer public servants, but we were luxury brands. We brag that we turn away 88% of our applicants, which is tantamount to the head of a housing shelter, a homeless shelter, bragging that he or she turned away 90% of our applicants last night. We have lost the script. We need to move back to a dramatic increase in freshman seats such that good kids, maybe they aren't remarkable, but good kids get remarkable opportunities, as I did, as I'm sure the two of you did back in the 80s and the 90s.
Talk to me more about this idea of the erosion of the core value, because that does seem to be an open question. I mean, it sounds like you're saying a lot of energy and resource could be expended creating an education experience that works online, but so far we haven't seen that.
We haven't. And to be clear, 100% online, you're just not going to be able to replicate the magic of the lawn at UVA, of football games, of spilling into adulthood, of rowing crew, of getting your heart broken and developing some resilience. There are very few as safe and as joyous a place to grow up, if you will, and explore things that you didn't, you know, curiosity and intellectual curiosity. Having said that, we should be able to offer that to more people without indebting their households to a greater level than household credit card debt. We've layered $1.5 trillion of debt on American households because we've been, quite frankly, preying on the hopes and dreams of middle-class households and a notion in America that you have to have a college degree and what I would argue is the great casting. So would we ever get back with 100% online? No, but could we in fact offer a equivalent, maybe even a better experience where we take the 50% of learning that doesn't need to be in person and flip the classroom, do some of the rote teaching online with better tools, better technologies, and then save the in-person stuff for a discussion and Q&A and dramatically expand the freshman seat. Stanford's applications have tripled in the last 30 years, but they haven't increased their freshman class one seat because they are drunk on luxury. The Ivy Leagues combined will educate 64,000 students. Ohio State educates 55,000. We've lost the script. We're no longer public servants. We're luxury goods. We need to go back to the notion that good kids should have remarkable educations as opposed to just the children of rich people and freakishly remarkable 15 to 17-year-olds who have patents, captain their class team, and build wells in Africa. The majority of us at the age of 17 or 18 aren't remarkable. That's not the judge of a society, how much opportunity you give to remarkable kids. The judge of our society and our education system, in my view, is how many remarkable opportunities are given to average kids. So I think we can get there. I think we can get to a equivalent or even better experience, admittedly not with all online, but with say 50% that will dramatically reduce the costs and give us the opportunity to expand freshman seats.
Let's talk about the institutions themselves and the ones that are going to survive. You have said the top 20 universities globally are going to become even stronger. 20 through 50 are going to be fine, but 50 to 1,000 are going to go out of business or become a shadow of themselves. What is it worth trying to reverse that? And if so, how?
Yeah, MIT's fine. UCLA is fine. They attract their global brands. These are the strongest brands in the world. People say Apple's the strongest brand in the world. No, it's not. MIT and Harvard are the strongest brands in the world. Nobody pays $100 million to have their name on the side of a building on the corporate campus of Apple. So those universities, Harvard has stated, the head of admissions at Harvard has stated that he could double the size of his incoming freshman class without sacrificing any quality. And then the obvious question is, well, with $38 billion endowment, why wouldn't you? And so that's where we need to be. We need to, these universities, the top 50 can expand enrollments dramatically. And I think the Ivies won't. I believe the Ivies are going to double down on exclusivity, their Dead Poet Society experience. They love the exclusivity. Yeah. They love being luxury brands. They're Hermes bags. They're not public servants. However, the opportunity among our public universities that educate two-thirds of the 11 million kids we're expecting to come back in the fall, the opportunity there, again, is a grand bargain. Let's increase the budgets for these schools, but demand that they deliver education at a lower cost per student and dramatically expand the size of the University of California, the University of Texas, Michigan, University of North Carolina. These are outstanding schools. There are outstanding students who don't get into these schools that should have the same opportunities that their parents had. But I think that the top 50 get stronger. We're seeing this across every industry. The strongest companies, the strongest two or three companies come out of the pandemic stronger. They consolidate the market. The culling of the herd, post the culling of the herd, The remaining elephants have more foliage to eat after the rains return. So you're going to see the biggest universities only garner, or the best brands only garner more and more strength. The high tuition, low brand tier two universities are going to have to go way into their waiting list when those top tier universities expand their freshman classes. They will be okay, but the tier three universities will reach into the waiting list, which they don't have. And they have cost structures that just don't afford the kind of decline in demand, the demand destruction they're going to register.
So what I hear you saying, though, is you'll have elite schools that get more elite and continue to concentrate wealth, which sounds a little familiar as an American story. You will have mass destruction of a middle to lower class. And then you will hopefully have a bunch of government investment from states whose budgets have been totally destroyed and who always turn to higher education when they need to cut in order to keep those schools going. And what that actually sounds like is kind of a bad recipe, assuming that the investment is unlikely, that the grand bargain is the part that has to be accomplished. That sounds like a big hill to climb.
I think that's a fair summary. And I think nothing's for free. But after speaking to and working at a university for 18 years, I think it is cost cutting is almost just not in their DNA. I think they're sooner to go out of business than they are to acknowledge. What have all these other industries been doing? They've been cutting costs. There hasn't been one conversation around a really open, honest conversation around cost cutting at universities. They're just assuming that everything's going to go back to normal, and it's not. But the opportunity, again, among public universities, because we are getting better at technology, will be to say to their local leaders and their citizens, look, there's an opportunity here. There's an opportunity to return to an age where we had 20, 30% of our applicants get in, where you didn't have to be remarkable. You just had to be strong. But there's no free lunch here. It's going to require the citizenry to elect officials that the reason I'm here talking to you guys is through the generosity and vision of California taxpayers and the vision of the Regents of the University of California. And without that same commitment, we used to refer to the University of California as the jewel of California. Hmm. We need to start thinking that way again. We need to start reaching into households with good, not necessarily great kids, and lifting them up, as opposed to bragging about how just insanely remarkable the 12% of our applicants who we let in are. But it's going to require a change in mindset among our elected officials. It's going to require sacrifice among my colleagues, that an overdue round of cost cutting where we hold ourselves more accountable, which I don't think we have been doing the last 40 years. But I think there's a big opportunity with technology here. A crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Let's not waste this crisis.
I think, Scott, honestly, you assume political courage that is absent in the current dialogue. But let's put that aside for a second, unless you'd care to answer that. And let me ask you the last question of the day, which is, was this change coming and the pandemic just brought it on faster? Were we going here anyway, do you think?
Yeah, so I think you're being deeply cynical, Kai. I think the world isn't what it is. I think the world is what we make of it. I think Gavin Newsom is a good man. I think Governor Cuomo is a good man. I think the man in the mirror, the woman in the mirror test, I think we as citizens are failing. I think we need to demand our leaders return to the same opportunity set for young people that we had around an ability to get a great education at a great public university. I think this could happen. I think it's absolutely up to us. I don't think there's anything wrong with America that can't be fixed with what's right with America. I think our education system is the upward lubricant, or used to be the upward lubricant of our society. It's slowly but surely turned into the caste system. But I think this is an opportunity for us to go back to where we were and continue to ensure that our leaders and our universities are up to the task of, again, returning universities to their rightful place as an upward lubricant of the middle class, such that the children of single immigrant mothers who lived and died a secretary, i.e. yours truly, have the opportunity to access incredible education at affordable rates.
Scott Galloway is a professor of marketing at the NYU Stern School of Business, just trying to burn down his office. Scott, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Scott, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Thanks for your good work, guys.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, interesting. I will say Erica Phillips in the Slack says, having attended a public university in another country, it is honestly grotesque, she says, how fancy U.S. universities are and how much money they clearly spend. Yeah. The comparison is sort of mind-blowing.
Yeah, for sure.
It's totally true. It's interesting, is compelling, is profound. It's also like there's such a long road for students before they even get to higher education and so many budget conversations to be had about. Anyway, yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. I like his optimism, though. Before we go into our break, send us your thoughts, your comments, especially those of you who might be returning students or professors. We want to hear your take on all this. Record yourself in a voice memo if you would, or feel free to email us. Send us to makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
News,
we promised.
news. We're back. That's right. For us sitting here doing it, it takes just a second. All y'all have like 30 seconds or a minute. I don't know.
No time at all. It's like, totally like, we'll be right back. We're back.
Oh, my goodness. The glory of post-production. Oh, man. All right. So, look, I know I've got two, but they're of a piece. I would have had three, but I figured that was being greedy.
Really?
So I would like to point out, a report from Goldman Sachs this morning. They did a bunch of analysis on this economy and where it's going and the pandemic and all of that stuff. And the nut graph, the payoff line, the whatever you want to call it, is this from Goldman Sachs. Thus, the upshot of our analysis is that a national face mask mandate could potentially substitute for renewed lockdowns that would otherwise subtract nearly 5% from gross domestic product. That is to say, you wear a mask, you save the economy. And I would just like to point that out. It's so not hard. And it makes
but
me
it
just
clearly,
bananas.
I mean, look.
What?
It's outrageous.
Yes.
The whole situation
yes.
is outrageous. The fact that yep. America, with 3% of the global population, has over a third of the deaths in the world related yep. to this disease is outrageous. And the fact that it is now the end of June yep. and we're still talking about whether we should have a national mask mandate. And people are just so confused that they have, like, been left to fight among themselves in the streets. I saw Kai's tweet about the taco truck in L.A. that had to close down. And the reason it closed down was nuts.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Literally closed down because they were like, we just can't keep fighting with people who come in here and have a fit about masks. And then I see people like, what would a national mask mandate do? You know what? Sometimes consistency of messaging. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Always. We could get our professor of marketing back who would probably verify that consistent messaging is everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
It's insane.
Anyway, on the plus side, we're getting closer.
To what?
To consistent messaging. We'll have to undo so much damage.
Well, look. I think it's very interesting that Mitch McConnell and Republicans in the Senate are now saying, oh, wear a mask.
Yeah.
Now, look, that's politically driven, right? They see the handwriting on the wall, but I think I'll take it, right?
Right.
You know.
No, it's good. Like, this is progress. Yeah. This is progress. I'm mad, yeah. but it's progress.
Yep.
What's your other thing?
All right, you go. I don't want to do my second one. Never mind.
Really?
It's just more okay. beating a dead horse. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mine is actually based on school and a conversation that I think everybody is starting to have right now, which is what is going to happen? We've been at home with our kids for this many months. Is it safe to go back to school? Are schools going to reopen? And I am just sort of putting a pin, I guess, in the conversation about kids and transmissibility and how much we don't know which things are like not settled science and which are. You know, like we know that we know that children are about half as likely as adults to catch COVID-19. Mm-hmm. We're still a little unclear about how much they spread it and don't have a ton of data because schools close pretty quickly. Some schools are reopening because in countries where there are low levels of infection, but like much to the point about university, you know, in the university setting, it's sort of like clear that it's delusional. Because, again, these are also young adults who, I mean, I agree right. with Professor right. Galloway on that point. It's like, you're insane if you think that college kids are going to come and not be dumb, right? And socially distance and not go to the bars.
And I mean, drunk when you look at the rates and all of that stuff, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. And making out constantly. Right. College is great.
All right.
But I think this question about but just I'm trying to go back to a simpler time in my mind for just a second. Mm-hmm. But this question about what is going to happen with younger kids and education, I think is like that's a conversation that also states have to get real about because parents are, you know, filled with a wild, angry hope or devastated if they've already heard otherwise or the hybrid model or whatever. And this is an area where I feel like. I don't know. From the science and policy and education perspective, we all need to get really real about talking about this because the social impacts, right. you know, there's data that says like 47% of working moms might drop out of the workforce if kids can't go back to school. Like it's really, it's really real. It's not settled. It's a very thorny question with a lot of risk attached to it. But like, can we start putting some real attention to this? I understand that apparently Dr. Fauci is talking about this now on in his Hill testimony, and I unfortunately don't know what he's saying because it's happening while we're recording. But I don't know. This is the conversation, guys.
For sure. We're talking about, I have it right, that we're talking about the whole childcare thing in this pandemic next week?
Yeah.
Which of course.
Oh, is that next week? Perfect.
I think so. And that's, you know, a huge part of that is people working from home when you've got kids who, you know, are on online school, which is, anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a big deal for the economy, speaking of which. All right. That is enough for our news. As Kai just said, it is now your turn to talk.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
So Sam, while he was producing this episode that we're talking about now on higher education, he reached out to a buddy of his. His name is Scott Bremmer. He's a professor of writing at the School of Visual Arts in New York and wanted his take on the whole remote learning situation. Here's what Scott sent us.
When classes were moved online last semester, I felt a sense of loss. I felt badly for my students who had to say goodbye to their friends. Also, I realized how attached I had become to the rituals of teaching, like packing my briefcase, dressing in a fun but professional way for class, and wiping down the dry erase boards first thing in the morning. Anyone who teaches knows it's a performance. You're conscious of being the center of attention, at the front of a room full of students, imbibing their energies, trying to figure out what they've brought to class that day, emotionally and intellectually. This fall, I'm online again, and I'm honestly a little relieved to take a break from the complexities of the classroom. But I know something has been lost. School is about more than the transmission of knowledge. It's also about community, about the incidental encounters you have with peers, maybe in the hall between classes, or while the professor is trying to figure out how to turn on the projector. Moments like those will be missed, but I think it'll be okay. Come to think of it, I learned almost everything I know online.
Yeah, as a great believer in routine and one who is sometimes unmoored without it, I totally get that. For sure.
Yeah. the routine thing. I think I was talking to a friend about school and at all the levels. I think I'm really real. This episode's making me really realize that I don't particularly have this like college fetish that many people do. Maybe I'm like, yeah, I don't know what happened. I think that there is something to the idea that, like, if we can figure out social interaction, let's say we did move to some kind of a hybrid model that lasted a long time, either because of COVID or because of equality or all of the reasons that schooling needs to evolve. I was talking to a friend and saying, like, I wonder if there is a version of sort of a star teacher model where it's sort of like you've got one teacher who just sort of delivers the lecture for potentially thousands of kids. And maybe that's even the case in middle school or elementary school, who leads it. And then you have an army of teachers who are kind of the producers, I guess, like, you know, who are compiling curriculum and advancing. I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways that education could evolve that are unrelated to this voice memo, but got me thinking about it.
Fair enough.
Last week, we did that pandemic update with Lauren Wold. We asked you to tell us how you're feeling about reopening. And I mean, I can't believe that was last week.
I know.
When now we're now, sorry, guys, like it's a week later, we're reclosing. Oops, too late. But just kidding. Here's a voice memo from listener Mark Regas.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Mark from State College, Pennsylvania. I really enjoyed your interview with Dr. Lauren Wold from Ohio State, as I did the previous time you interviewed him. Except one little thing that gets me unsettled is that he kept talking about people having to make individual risk determinations as they do various activities. And I do the same thing. But I think in the back of our heads, we also have to realize that our individual risk determinations are also going to affect our loved ones, the people we live with, and larger communities. We go back and forth between telling people they need to make their individual risk determinations and also telling people we're all in this together. And I think we need to be more consistent in our messaging with that, because our individual risk determinations do have an impact on others. Thanks.
Yes, totally. Mm. Totally, totally agree. But it's individual risk and collective responsibility, right? I think that's the deal. I think that's how you got to frame it. Now, that's the way I try to.
And I think, frankly, this is the tension with everything that you do in life, right? If you drive a bigger car than other people on the road, then you've made the risk determination that you want a bigger, safer car, but you're putting somebody in a smaller car at risk, right? Like, it. To be fair, and I'm cognizant that this is a pandemic and it's a hard conversation, a hard set of conversations to have, but what you're describing, this tension between individual risk determinations and collective behavior, like you said, Kai, is the tension we live with every single day. Every single day.
Yep.
And in some ways, it has not changed. It just is less clear because we know less and are finding out more every day, and because everybody apparently is on a totally different page about what we think we know, which is also tricky. But it's life or death risk determination. But as Bob Wachter, my favorite from UCSF, puts it, it's also about probability.
Yep. And you got to factor that in.
All right.
Okay. So, Make Me Smart question coming up. What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about this week? Artist Rhonda Brown. She is a fine artist, works for the City Colleges of Chicago as the Vice Chancellor for Institutional Advancement. And she sends us this answer about the first Black U.S. Congresswoman, Shirley Chisholm. Here you go.
Something I thought I knew, but turned out I was completely wrong about, is that Black political leaders are iconic mostly only to Black people. Not one, but two of my friends, both who are white and completely independent of one another, commissioned me to create paintings of their hero, Shirley Chisholm. I don't know why this was such a surprise to me, but it was well before the New York Times proclaimed Shirley as the year 2019 belonged to Shirley Chisholm, and really before all the 50-year celebrations in 2018. She made so many bold statements about her Blackness. She was the people's politician. She was unbossed and unbought, in her own words, and unapologetic about her mission in Congress. And truthfully, until that moment, I had not realized her impact was so deeply ingrained into the American psyche that it would have the possibility to reach all the way to suburban white America. But it did. And as an artist, I feel really proud to have had the opportunity to paint an image of someone who means so much to so many and still inspires us today.
I love that.
Amen. Yeah, that was great.
I love that.
That was great.
Also, I feel like I would like to, can I make an on-air request to Erica Phillips? Like, don't you want a little Shirley Chisholm info in the newsletter? I do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We'll do that.
Yeah.
Well,
yay.
I think we should do that.
Will we? Totally. We totally will.
Whatever.
Fingers crossed.
You know.
All right. Goodness. That is it for our show today. I know we're limping toward the finish. Don't forget to sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters. And we will be back tomorrow with What Do You Want to Know Wednesday.
It is kind of hummable when you think about it, this song.
Make Me Smart has a lot of people who work on it, and that is true, and they are all great. But today, we got to say goodbye to our senior producer, Jody Becker, and it is a bummer. She is wise and calm and our mom. She's like the Make Me Smart mom, and she has steered this ship low these many months, and we are grateful, Jody. Thank you.
Through pandemic and lockdown and all the stuff that is happening, she's kept this show on track daily, in point of fact.
Daily.
Kept it on the daily tracks. That's right.
I was just saying. Right. Yeah, there she was. Like, I'll fill in on the show. I got you guys. Hey, right. Jody, do you mind doing this every day, though?
We're going to do it daily now. We're going to do it daily.
And she didn't. She didn't mind.
Didn't mind at all.
You rock, Jody Becker. We will miss you.
And everybody else who works on the show, you know their names anyway. We'll get them tomorrow.
Yeah. We'll get them tomorrow. She gets her own day, damn it.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.